The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This was a thoughtful process. The military piece of this run out of the Pentagon largely, but the State Department was fully involved in the strategic pieces of this. And I am very confident that our mission to deter Russia, the NATO mission to deter Russia, we are still fully capable of executing. And there comes a point where you're spending $500 million of U.S. taxpayer money year on year that goes to benefit political actors inside the World Health Organization. And we ultimately made the conclusion that we were more likely to achieve the global health security issues that the United States cares about deeply if we did not participate any further in the World Health Organization. I am not at all convinced that it will be China that benefits from that. I'm convinced that the world will benefit. We saw it with PEPFAR. We've seen it with Gavi. We've seen it other places. When the United States leads, and we will absolutely lead, good things can happen in the international health realm.
Can a president delay a presidential election?
Senator, the Department of Justice, others will make that legal determination. We all should want, I know you do too, Senator Kaine, we want to make sure we have an election that everyone is confident in. It's not only free,
Are you indifferent to the date of the election?
It should happen lawfully.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm Elena Kagan, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 31st, 2020. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Thursday. Pompeo was asked about the threats posed by China and Russia, the decision to withdraw 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany, the upcoming presidential election, and much more. The hearing did include some grandstanding and repetition, but we cut out all the theatrics to leave you with just the questions and answers that you need to hear. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 31st. Pompeo versus the committee with no bull.
With that, Secretary Pompeo.
Today I'm here to present the and testify about the President's 2021 budget. It requests nearly $41 billion for the State Department and USAID, enabling both agencies to protect U.S. citizens, increase American prosperity, and advance the development of democratic societies. And critically, it reflects a commitment to the strategic, efficient use of resources to provide better results for the American people. That's the top-line analysis, but I want to make a broader point, that our diplomatic expenditures reflect America's values. 2 weeks ago in Philadelphia, I unveiled the report of the State Department's Commission on Unalienable Rights. My message that day was simple. The Trump administration places our founding principles at the very core of American diplomacy. I want to talk about how we've done that in three areas. First, securing the American people's freedoms against authoritarian threats, securing American lives during the pandemic, and helping friends across the world secure those very unalienable rights. On authoritarian threats, we've evaluated the world with the same realism that the American founders did. We see the Islamic Republic of Iran for what it is, an aggressor, not a victim. We've gone full bore on our maximum pressure campaign since May of 2018. We've slashed the vital oil revenues the regime uses for terrorism and illegal nuclear activities by 90%. We've rallied nations to our side through diplomacy, witnessed the designations of Hezbollah from European and South American countries. And we've bolstered our military readiness vis-a-vis Tehran. There's more work to do. The Security Council must renew the UN arms embargo against Iran before it expires on October 18th. Iran already mines ships in the Straits of Hormuz, launches missiles at Saudi oil facilities, and ships arms to the Houthis. Should the Security Council fail to act, Iran will have a freer hand to sow destruction across the Middle East and indeed the world. Russia, too, is a destabilizing authoritarian force in Ukraine, in Libya, in Syria, and inside of Western democracies. This administration has acted to protect our interests and our friends. We've issued the Crimea Declaration. We've supplied Ukraine with lethal military hardware. We've sanctioned more than 360 Russian targets for everything from human rights abuses to supporting the murderous Assad regime to operating mercenaries and proxy forces around the world. And the State Department's FY 2021 request for the Global Engagement Center is $138 million, more than double its current level. We won't tolerate disinformation and other propaganda directed by the Kremlin or any of our other adversaries. Further on Russia, 2 weeks ago, the State Department removed Nord Stream 2's exemption under CATSA, and in December, the administration's swift implementation of PISA, an important bipartisan endeavor, effectively halted construction of the pipeline. We're the toughest administration ever on Russia. Most importantly, on China, we see the Chinese Communist Party also for what it is, the central threat of our times. Our vigorous diplomacy has helped lead an international awakening to the threat of the CCP. Senators, the tide's turning. 30-plus countries and territories have become 5G-clean countries, banning untrusted vendors from their networks. When we talked about this some year ago, the number was in the single digits. In our hemisphere, Canada has stood firm against the Chinese Communist Party's hostage-taking. Its three major telecom carriers have also banned untrusted vendors. Belize and Haiti have denounced Beijing's national security law targeting Hong Kong. Denmark has rejected the CCP's attempted censorship of Danish newspapers. Sweden has closed its Confucius Institutes. Lithuanian intelligence services have identified China as a potential threat for the first time. And in the region, in the Indo-Pacific, Australia declares China's South China Sea claims unlawful and illegitimate, as have we. And we're proud to have stepped up maritime maneuvers in that body of water alongside our friends from Australia and Japan and the United Kingdom. India has banned 106 Chinese applications that threatened its citizens' privacy and security. Our diplomatic efforts are working, and momentum is building to mitigate the threats that the Chinese Communist Party presents. All 10 ASEAN nations have insisted that the South China Sea disputes must be settled on the basis of international law, including UNCLOS. Japan led the G7's condemnation of China's national security law targeting Hong Kong. The EU condemned the law, too, and also declared China a systemic rival just last year. And we've agreed to start a dialogue channel focused solely on China at the EU's request. At NATO, Secretary General Stoltenberg has called to make China a greater part of that alliance's focus as well. And we led a multilateral effort to ensure that the United Nations World Intellectual Property Organization elected a director from a country that actually gave a darn about intellectual property rights. And our Quad, the United States, Australia, India, and Japan, has been reinvigorated. We've worked hard at this. Our diplomats have done wonderful work. I'm very proud of the progress we are making. In addition to these multilateral efforts, the Department of Justice is cracking down on Chinese IP threats. We've sanctioned Chinese leaders for their brutality in Xinjiang, imposed export controls on companies that support it, and warned U.S. businesses against using slave labor in their supply chains. We've terminated special treatment agreements with Hong Kong in response to the CCP's actions to deny freedom to the people of Hong Kong, and we closed our consulate in Houston because it was a den of spies. Our budget reflects this efforts, the reality on the ground. We requested nearly $1.5 billion for foreign assistance to the Indo-Pacific region, a 20% increase from the 2020 request. We want that part of the world to be free and open and prosperous.
With that, Senator Menendez.
Have you raised concerns with Russia, its Foreign Minister Lavrov, with respect to Russia reportedly placing bounties on the heads of service members in Afghanistan?
Well, I want to be very careful about what's public record and what's intelligence-based, but yes, I can assure you and the American people that each time I've spoken with Foreign Minister Lavrov, I've raised all of the issues that put any American interest at risk, whether it's our soldiers on the ground in Syria, soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, the activities that are taking place in Libya, the actions in Ukraine, each and every one of these that potentially threaten American interests are things that I raised in my conversations with taking place in Libya, the actions in Ukraine, each and every one of these that potentially threaten American interests are things that I raised in my conversations with Foreign Minister Lavrov, and I speak with him with some frequency.
I appreciate that answer. I ask you specifically, have you raised concerns? This is in the public sphere. I'm not talking about classified
materials. It's not classified, Senator.
Have you raised, there are public reports, very well documented, that the Russians were supposedly paying bounties to kill our service members. Have you raised that issue with Foreign Minister Lavrov?
Senator, I'm going to be more careful than you're being with respect to the intelligence. I'm going to tell you that, make no mistake about it, the proper people have been aware of every single threat to our soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, whether that was General Miller or my team at the embassy there in Kabul. Anytime there was a tactical threat on the lives or the health or the safety and security or our assets in place, we have raised this with our Russian counterparts, not only at my level, but Ambassador Sullivan and every one of our team that interacts with the Russians. We've made very clear our expectations.
Let me turn to
threaten us in Afghanistan.
Let me turn to a few other questions. Maybe you can answer these just simply yes or no. I think they're just factual in nature. Did Turkey purchase the S-400 system from the Russian Federation?
Yes.
Did Turkey pay approximately $2.5 billion for that system?
Senator, I'm not aware of the amount of the transaction.
But they did pay them whatever the amount is, right?
Senator, I believe that's correct. I apologize. I am not certain that the cash has been exchanged.
Does the Turkish government currently have the S-400 in its possession?
It has an S-400, yes.
Did Turkey test the S-400 radar on an American-built F-16? President raised the S-400 with President Erdogan?
I don't talk about things that the president speaks about with foreign counterparts.
When will the administration follow the law and impose CATSA sanctions on Turkey?
Senator, in response to the Turkish government's acquisition of the S-400, we've taken significant actions that have had a real impact on Turkey. We've pulled out a very significant weapons program that they were building significant pieces of inside of Turkey, the F-35 program. And we continue to evaluate how to apply sanctions in order to achieve our end objective. Our end objective isn't to punish. It's to ensure that our NATO partner acts in a way that's consistent with American national security and the security of our NATO partners as well. Our diplomats, Ambassador Satterfield on the ground, are working diligently.
You had the Inspector General of the State Department, Mr. Linick, ultimately fired. Is that correct?
I recommended to the president that he be terminated, yes.
And you recommended it to the president that he be terminated. Why? Because he was conducting investigations that may affect you?
Senator, at the time I made the recommendation to the president, I was unaware of any of the investigations that were ongoing, that he had ongoing at the time, with one exception. I was aware of an investigation that he had asked me to provide testimony. I provided that testimony. Other than that, I was unaware of any investigation. It's not remotely the reason.
Was your undersecretary, Mr. Bulatel, aware, and didn't he speak to you about it?
He did not speak to me about it.
Senator Johnson.
There were 126 leaks having to do with national security in the first 125 days of this administration. That needs to be investigated. And I'm not, if you could describe the leaks that you were concerned about and exactly how Inspector General Linick didn't handle that the way you thought it should be handled.
Sure. So thank you, Senator Johnson. Let me just say, I value Inspectors General as well. I had a great relationship with the Inspector General at the CAA when I was there. He did his job. He took care of the team. He was critical of the agency when we got it wrong. I know what a good IG can do. Inspector General Linick wasn't that. The incident that you're referring to is that we had a very sensitive Inspector General report. When the final draft was prepared, it leaked. The Politico reporter, I think, said it came from two people close to the investigation. At that point, it was basically the IG's office and a couple of others that actually knew about it in the full report, which had a real impact on senior State Department officials' lives. When we confronted the Inspector General, he was defensive. We then asked him to undertake a process. He ignored that request to inspect, to have a separate IG come and investigate. It's pretty complicated, but suffice it to say, he didn't comply with the instructions about how we felt that leak needed to be investigated so that we could have an independent investigator do it, and then he wasn't candid about that process either. He didn't act with integrity throughout that process in a way that inspector generals have to be counted on to behave.
Were there any other specific incidents that caused you to ask for the removal of Inspector General Linick?
Yes, there were. There were several. Look, at the end, it's about the core mission, accomplishing the core function. One of the central functions to make sure that we can represent to you all that the financial statement for the State Department is accurate and full. We have an audit team to do that. Inspector General Linick screwed that up. I'll read from the investigative report. It said, oversight by the OIG was demonstrably ineffective, ultimately placing the department's information as well as the reputation, human capital, and operations at considerable and unnecessary risk. That's an enormous failure for one of the most important tasks that the IG's office does, conduct the audit of the State Department's books. There's a handful of others. He refused to take care of his team in important ways. There were 10% fewer audits of our posts around the world. One of the most important functions, aside from the audit, is to travel around the posts and conduct audits to make sure that they're conducting business appropriately. We were down about 10%. And I must tell you, morale inside the IG's office, of all, we have 38 assistant secretary level bureaus. The IG's office was the worst survey results of any of those 38. He didn't take care of his people either.
Senator Cardin.
I was pleased to hear you mention as the first order of your remarks today, human rights and values, American values. But I was disappointed that you used the Commission on Inalienable Rights as the example. And I say that because in my conversations with human rights advocates, not just here but globally, they look at the United States trying to promote a political agenda on rights rather than working with the international community, the free world, on democratic principles of human rights. So tell me how this commission has engaged the activists globally that are fighting every day for human rights when it is very much tied towards a particular political view rather than a universal view on human rights.
Senator, I appreciate the answer to talk a little bit about the commission and the objective I set out now just over a year ago with respect to it. I'd urge everyone to take a look at it and read it. I think they did phenomenal work. I don't agree with everything that's in there. I don't think any of the 10 members that came from broad religious backgrounds, broad political backgrounds, I don't think any of the 10 of them agree with just everything in there. But what it set out to do was take on what is an enormous crisis in the 20th century's human rights project. We're in a really bad place all around the world. And it was my view as I watched the State Department, our department, our DRL, all the folks who work on this who are great and amazing people, I watched as they were unmoored. They didn't have a founding. And so I wanted to go back and talk about how do we moor American foreign policy and American human rights policy in the traditions of the United States. And so that's what the commission was asked to do.
What oversight are you deploying to make sure that arms that we make available to other countries are used for the intended purpose and do not end up for the wrong use?
Senator, we have an elaborate process to do our best to verify that that doesn't happen. It's not that we don't have escapes, that there aren't failures. It's certainly the case. That's been true for an awfully long time. But we have an elaborate process to validate and verify. We require representations. We do verification. We do inspections. We have big teams in multiple departments that have responsibility for doing their best to ensure that American weapon systems are used for their intended purpose when we sell them or provide them to our partners and allies around the world.
The GAO recently issued a report that I had requested in regards to diversity. And the report's titled, State Department, Additional Steps Are Needed to Identify Potential Barriers to Diversity. And they point out that from the period from 2002, well before your time, to 2018, we've seen a decline of minorities in positions within the State Department, and it's particularly pronounced within the higher ranks. What steps are you taking to implement the GAO concerns?
So, Senator, I've seen that GAO report. I've seen the internal work we've done. I would characterize it over the last, that you were talking about from 2002, over the last decade roughly as flat. That's not good enough. That's multiple parties. This is not partisan at all. We want to get this right. We've undertaken a number of things. We have about a third today of our members who are minorities. Excuse me, about 44% of them are women. We've developed the Pickering Rangel program to bring more people in. We had double the applications this year. We have a big team that works on diversity and inclusion. And we're almost finished with a major study that was begun now, I think, 13 months ago, run by Carol Perez, our DGHR, to look at what the failures. There's been a lot of money and effort on diversity and inclusion over this last decade with, to your point, relatively good outcomes for acquisition of new talented people, but less so at the senior levels. Trying to identify why we haven't.
I hope we could work together on that.
Senator Gardner.
In 2018, the Asia Subcommittee held a three-part hearing series. We talked about democracy, human rights, and rule of law. We found that mass concentration camps for Uyghur Muslims necessitated a serious response from the U.S. and the international community. The crackdowns in the Tibet Autonomous Region are intensifying, while Beijing continues to refuse negotiations with the Central Tibetan Administration. That human rights defenders in China are routinely jailed and tortured. I was obviously pleased to see that several Chinese officials were sanctioned for abuses against Uyghurs, and even in the 11 Chinese entities implicated in similar abuses were added to the Commerce Department's entity list. But what is the administration doing to address further global Magnitsky sanctions and other remedies for these abuses?
So, Senator Gardner, thanks. And I'm familiar with the area. It's great work. And I want to thank this committee and frankly, the broader group of senators for the bipartisan legislation that we had with respect to the Uyghurs and respect to Hong Kong democracy as well. It's very powerful when I can talk to my counterparts around the world and say that I have not only the support of Congress, but bipartisan, almost unanimous support on our policy with respect to securing freedom against the threats that the Chinese Communist Party is presenting. As for what we'll continue to do in Western China with respect to the horrific human rights violations that are taking place against the ethnic minorities there, I don't want to get in front of the final decisions, but you can rest assured that there are further actions, including further actions with respect to human rights violations that the Department of State and the Department of Treasury are working to complete.
Can you talk a little bit about tech and China and what you see, what's happening? Is it true that there's no Chinese technology theft of U.S. companies?
Well, they need to get out more. I mean, there's a long history, decades-long history, of Chinese intellectual property threat, including against technologies. And I hear it. It's sometimes the case you hear it privately because there's continued threats made against their businesses that are operating not only in China, but threats to businesses that are actually working in other parts of Asia and Southeast Asia as well. The Chinese Communist Party is completely willing to bully and to threaten to get companies to behave.
Do you work with these tech companies at State Department on intellectual property theft, cyber attack, those kinds of things?
We do. We work closely with them. And on the side of protecting cyber, we've actually had some good work where we've worked alongside each other on important projects where we have reduced risk. And so I thank them for that. But the idea that anyone in the tech space could not know of what the Chinese Communist Party is attempting to steal and the cyber attacks they're making seems incredulous.
Are the tech companies doing enough to combat Chinese disinformation?
No, there's always more that they can do. There's more we can do as well. On that particular front, I must say, I actually think the world mounted a very effective counter campaign against the Chinese disinformation. As I've traveled and as I've spoken to my counterparts, I think the world understands that this virus emanated from China, from Wuhan in particular, and I think the world understands that the Chinese Communist Party showed up with PPE that didn't work and covered up what they knew about that when they could have prevented this spread. So I think the Chinese efforts at disinformation there actually failed in this case.
The Taiwan situation, I wanted to just ask a question about bilateral trade agreements and opportunities for Taiwan. Yesterday I sent a letter to U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer, Ambassador Lighthizer, asking for the U.S. to begin engaging in a bilateral trade agreement with Taiwan. Can you talk a little bit about the administration's pursuit of such an agreement?
Senator Gardner, I'd prefer to leave that to Ambassador Lighthizer to talk about that. We're aware that there's great interest in this. The State Department will have its part in that. But our primary work with respect to Taiwan is different from the trade piece of this. We've been diligent about making sure that we honor the commitments that we have made to the people of Taiwan, including approving arms sales that are important so that the Taiwanese can engage and the activities that they need to do so they can protect their democracy.
And the administration's goal of complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula remains?
It does.
Thank you.
Senator Shaheen.
Were you involved in the decision to withdraw troops from Germany?
Yes.
According to Secretary Esper, 6,400 of those troops, so over half of those who will be removed from Germany, will be coming back to the United States. They're not going to be going to parts of Europe to deter Russia, to parts of Asia to deter China. In fact, the only country that has publicly supported the removal of U.S. troops from Germany to date has been Russia. So can you share with us whether the impact of this decision on our efforts to counter China and Russia was taken into account, and was there any sort of strategic assessment done to support this decision?
Senator Shaheen, thanks for the question. Of course there was, and we were very involved at the strategic level. Obviously, the troop-level decisions and the like are primarily the Department of Defense and the President's role. You characterized the folks who were coming back to the United States as somehow being off the field. That's not the case. These units will participate in rotational activity. They'll be forward deployed. They won't be stationed or garrisoned. But make no mistake about it, they will be fully available to ensure that we can properly prosecute the challenges we have from the global powers.
Well, Mr. Secretary, I assume that all of our troops who are in the United States are available to be forward deployed. Now, I recognize that there are certain training that needs to be part of them before they are deployed, but I guess I don't understand, and was the effect of diplomatically alienating Germany, who is the largest and wealthiest country in the EU, who has been a historic strategic ally, was that also taken into consideration?
Maybe not. As for our strategic effort, General Secretary Stoltenberg, NATO commander, was very much in the process of helping us think this through. I saw comments out of Russia this morning that are different than you described, that viewed the actions that we took as threatening, because we will have soldiers that are deployed closer to the Russian border. Yes, this was a thoughtful process. The military piece of this run out of the Pentagon largely, but State Department was fully involved in the strategic pieces of this, and I am very confident that our mission to deter Russia, the NATO mission to deter Russia, we are still fully capable of executing. The precise number was 200,000 early, about 100-some thousand when I was there. Conditions have changed around the world, and our forces need to be repositioned to appropriately confront today's challenges.
Well, I would just read from a report in Bloomberg that quotes Dmitry Peskov, who was the press secretary for Vladimir Putin, who says that, and I quote, "The fewer American soldiers on the European continent, the calmer it is in Europe," Peskov said, answering a question on planned U.S. troop reductions in Germany. That doesn't sound to me like they think that this increases the threat from Russia. There was a report last night that said that state officials have secretly warned Russia against bounties on our troops, against killing our troops. What more do you think we should be doing to address that, to prevent the Taliban and Russia from trying to murder our troops in Afghanistan?
So there are many things, and we've been engaged in them consistently. There's intelligence collection so that if it happens, we can identify it, stop it, make sure that the actual tactical event doesn't take place. That's the task of not only DOD intelligence services, but our broader intelligence services. Our diplomats, too, make very clear our expectations and set a set of red lines. And then we have our larger Afghanistan policy. It's not just Russia that has been underwriting the Taliban for all these years. I know there's an awful lot of focus on that in this town. But let me tell you, at the State Department, Department of Defense, we're worried about Iranian support to the Taliban. We're worried about Gulf money coming to the Taliban. We are working.
I totally agree with that.
We are working diligently against every one of those threats, both diplomatically and from a security perspective, to protect our soldiers. And then finally, to protect our soldiers further, we've been working diplomatically to get peace and reconciliation in Afghanistan. And we have a ceasefire that began at the start of Eid al-Adha. We've now had a significant prisoner exchange. Since February 29th, the agreement entered into, we haven't had a single attack against an American soldier. This is the finest in American diplomacy, and I'm incredibly proud of what my team has done, my State Department team has done, to protect American soldiers.
So do you think it would be helpful for President Trump to talk to Vladimir Putin and tell him that he needs to back off in terms of paying the Taliban to kill American troops?
I always leave to the president what he wants to say to other leaders. I don't think there's any doubt in the mind of every Russian leader, including Vladimir Putin, about the expectations of the United States of America not to kill Americans. And I can promise you that the 300 Russians who were in Syria and who took action that threatened America who are no longer on this planet understand that too.
When you were here last time, we talked about the potential for negotiations with the Taliban in Afghanistan. That was before an agreement was reached. And there was an exchange that you and I had about the role of Afghan women in any talks with the Taliban. And you said that Afghan women should fend for themselves. Well, we've seen the outcome of our reticence to support Afghan women. The agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban failed to mention the rights of Afghan women, and it contains no guarantees for their continued constitutional protection. Is the policy to have Afghan women fend for themselves consistent, do you believe, with the legal mandate for the U.S. to support the, and I quote, the meaningful inclusion of women in peace talks as directed by the Women, Peace, and Security Act that was signed into law by President Trump?
Well, I'd have to go look and see what I said. No, we're doing our level best to make sure that we protect every Afghan, male and female. And I have seen the at least tentative composition of the Afghan negotiating team, and I think you'll be pleased with it.
Well, I'm out of time, but the fend for themselves is an exact quote from your statement when you were before this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Shaheen. Mr. Secretary, people always say actions speak louder than words. Do you think the specific action the United States of America took against General Soleimani sent a message to every country on this planet of what would happen to people who targeted United States soldiers on the battlefield?
I do.
Thank you. Senator Romney.
What actions will the administration take to bring our allies together in a way that's different than what we've done in the past? I mean, I know that we there's always lots of talk going on, and any administration can talk about all the things happening, but what are we going to do that's distinct, that's different, that's dramatic to bring the nations that follow the rule of law together?
Senator, it is absolutely the case that to confront the Chinese Communist Party is going to take a global effort. That's absolutely true. That's why I talked about this idea, perhaps, of a new alliance of democracies. What shape that would take, there's lots of discussion about. I've had many conversations with friends in the region. Step one, Senator, to be honest with you, has been to awaken the world to this threat. For an awful long time, not just the United States, but the whole world saw that there were lucrative opportunities in China, and that was basically foreign policy. Sell as much as you can, outsource jobs, build supply chains. And so I spent my first year and change traveling the world, trying to raise awareness of the threat. So that, I think that's new and different. You may say it's not enough, but it wasn't happening before. And I went through the list of things that have begun to turn the tide. I will say there are still nations who understand this threat but don't feel like they are empowered, that they're in a position where they can withstand the threats that come from the Chinese Communist Party. So we are working, our diplomats, trying to build out a set of relationships. And whether that's part of a formal organization or not, I'm not sure I know the answer to yet, but to convince them that America is prepared to lead in pushing back against the Chinese Communist Party, and when they do, we will be there to support them. And so I could list you, we have some 26 lines of effort at the State Department, probably an equal amount at the Department of Defense, all aimed centrally at building out this set of alliances, both in Southeast Asia and more broadly with our Five Eyes partners and with the Quad, to build out a set of commitments that can robustly communicate to the Chinese Communist Party that enough, you have to behave on the global stage. If you want to behave on the global stage, you've got to do it under a set of rules that has created so much prosperity around the world. And that may be unsatisfying, Senator Romney, but there's still a real work in progress to get everyone fully aligned. I mentioned the EU dialogue, very important. Foreign Minister Borrell, High Representative Borrell, asked me if we would have a dialogue with them on China. That took a lot of effort to get 27 EU nations to say, yes, this is something we've got to confront, to identify as a systemic rival. There's lots of spade work that goes into what seems pretty simple, I suppose.
Finally, were you surprised by the fact that, 57 countries supported China, 53 countries supported China's crackdown on Hong Kong? Did that shock you as it did me?
I was surprised and dismayed.
Senator Coons.
I'm working with members of this committee and your department to resolve terrorism-related claims against Sudan, which is in the middle of a critical democratic transition, to provide justice and compensation for over 700 terror victims and their family members, and to move our bilateral relationship forward after 30 years under the brutal dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir. Have you personally engaged on this issue, and can you commit to working transparently with Congress as we try to find a solution urgently?
Senator Coons, thank you for your work. This is really important. We've proposed that there's a legal peace resolution that would be in legislation that will be before Congress here in the very, very near term. We think it's the appropriate time to both bring justice to those from the 1998 bombings and get a real opportunity for Prime Minister Hamdok. I've talked to him a handful of times. I've talked to other of the leaders there in Sudan. This is an opportunity that doesn't come along often. We all know the history of Sudan and the tragedy there. There's a chance not only for democracy to begun to be built out, but perhaps regional opportunities that could flow from that as well. And I think lifting the state sponsor of terrorism designation there, if we can take care of the victims of those tragedies, would be a good thing for American foreign policy, and I appreciate your assistance in that regard.
On the Global Fragility Act, it's legislation that was bipartisan that I led here with Senator Graham and President Trump signed into law last December. It requires a long-term whole-of-government strategy to address extremism and instability in fragile states. Now, the first deliverable under this legislation, the Global Fragility Strategy, is due September 15th. Congress really isn't looking for old wine in new bottles, so we just urge you to look at the GFA as a tool to rethink our approach to these challenges and improve the way that state, AID, and DOD work together. How are you using the tools Congress provided in the GFA to address the consequences of this pandemic on development, governance, security? And can you commit that you'll look hard at and resolve a technical issue on the creation of the Prevention and Stabilization Fund, which was designed to replace and improve on the Rapid Response Fund in the statute?
Senator Coons, I'll get back to you on the last question that you asked. I'm familiar with it, but not enough to answer your question, but I'll get you an answer briefly. You're right. I'm tracking the first deliverable. I will say I saw the first pass at this. You characterized it about right. It was... there wasn't much that was original in there, and I've asked the team to go back and take a set of fresh looks to ask for outside views, folks on Capitol Hill, people who are experts around the world, to see if we can't use this tool that you provided us on a bipartisan basis to actually deliver on the stated objectives of that law. It was an important piece of legislation, and I don't want to miss the chance to develop the strategy that can then underpin all the actions we can take once that strategy is done. It's not something we intend to put on the shelf and admire, but something we hope creates operational opportunities underneath that strategy.
Mr. Secretary, I want to ask a last question about our election. President Trump has just tweeted that we should delay it. I'm interested in whether you were able to vote by mail when you served abroad in the Army, whether you vote by mail in your home state of Kansas, whether, like many of us who serve in Congress in both parties, you've availed yourself, as do virtually all of our diplomats and development professionals and armed forces members, of the opportunity to vote securely by mail. Have you done so, and do you have any concerns about the security of our election this November?
Senator Coons, I believe I have voted by absentee ballot. I think while I was a soldier, and I also think when I was a member of Congress, I did a couple times as well. The State Department has some role in making sure we have election security. It's not our primary focus. So I'll leave to others those who have that primary centered focus.
But is there any reason for us to be concerned that those votes are fraudulent or somehow ineligible to be counted if cast by mail or by absentee ballot by our diplomats?
Senator, I must say, having a small group of people vote by absentee ballot is very different than deciding that you're going to conduct a full in-mail balloting, an in-mail balloting program. Those are two fundamentally different beasts. I'll leave to the professionals to identify the level of risk associated with that. But I also know, and I saw this in my home state of Kansas, when you change the voting rules in close to an election, it's a difficult task.
Senator Rubio.
I'm sure you're well aware of influence efforts on the part of the Chinese in Taiwan to shape Taiwanese policies, the policies of their government. I'm certain, as most people on this committee, I hope, are aware of how they pressure political figures that they view are opposed to their interests. And I think we've all witnessed, I think you'll confirm this worldwide, that China has engaged in efforts of disinformation, particularly, for example, about the coronavirus. I'm not asking you to comment specifically about our country. I think I'm more than anything else asking, if China ever decided they wanted to do those kinds of things to us, would you assess they have the capability to conduct disinformation campaign to pressure American political figures, potentially even members of Congress, the way we've seen them do Taiwan and Australia and in other places? If they decided they wanted to do that, this is second largest economy in the world, pretty significant capabilities. If they ever decided they wanted to come after us that way, they'd have the capability to do it, would they not?
Senator, I'll take it if I have just a second to respond to this. They certainly have the capability. I've talked about this. The Chinese United Front is working here in the United States today. They're meeting with state legislators. They're meeting with governors. They're running one of the things that was taking place out of the consulate in Houston were influence operations conducted by their diplomats. And this isn't, I all know, we have diplomats from all across the world who come to our offices as members of Congress and talk to us about policy. This is what I'm talking about is fundamentally different from that. So they not only have the capability, but the intention of conducting influence operations in the United States. I think we're a pretty resilient nation. I'm confident that we'll push back against that. But the world needs to understand that when it's happening here in the United States, it's happening all across. It's happening in their countries, too.
Well, I think one of the things the most interesting yesterday is the four CEOs of these tech companies appeared, I believe, before a House committee yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, and they were asked a very simple question. Do they believe that China steals technology from U.S. firms? They were asked this question. I think there's pretty strong consensus across the board in both parties and in the media and elsewhere that the answer to that question is yes. The CEO of Apple said they haven't experienced it. That was his answer. The CEO of Google said, neither have we. And the CEO of Amazon says, I've read that. Only the CEO of Facebook said, yes, absolutely. So Apple, Google, and Amazon answered that question by saying either they hadn't experienced it or they've read that somewhere but wouldn't comment further. Why would corporations such as this, some of whom, by the way, take it upon themselves to censor truth versus what's not true and what they believe some people should be saying and not others on the basis of what they judge to be true. Why would three of the four CEOs of the four largest tech companies headquartered in the United States be afraid to answer that question?
Senator, I can only speculate. I mean, it's patently clear to anyone who's watching that the Chinese are engaged in intense efforts at intellectual property threat, including to technology.
Would it be fair in your mind to speculate that they try to influence people even in the business community?
Absolutely.
I mean, there is no doubt at this point that they have a very carefully crafted plan to dominate certain key industries for the 21st century and to wipe out not just our capabilities in those industries, but everybody else's. That's a fair assessment.
Yes, Senator Rubio, and they've not been covert about this, right? They've spoken openly about how they're approaching their commercial interests. The only thing that they don't speak about is that rather than build these industries inside, the tools that they use are fundamentally different than the way Western democracies do, right? We train our people, we build our businesses, we invest capital in the market. They run state-sponsored enterprises. They steal intellectual property, and then they endeavor to undermine other companies and threaten and bully countries around the world into buying their products.
As you understand our policy, being in the position that you're in, could you envision, as long as this administration is in office, we would ever negotiate with the Maduro regime for them to remain in power?
Absolutely not. Our policy is not to negotiate for them for anything other than his departure from ruling that country.
Senator Udall?
Secretary Pompeo, if President Trump refuses to accept the upcoming November election due to his lack of faith in voting by mail, will you respect the results of a certified election as the State Department typically does throughout the world?
Senator, I'm not going to speculate. You had about 15 ifs in there. You should know. I have said repeatedly to this committee, I will follow the rule of law, follow the Constitution, I've endeavored to do that in everything I've done, and I'll continue to do that every day.
Are you concerned that instead of promoting press freedom abroad, America is now providing moral support to authoritarian efforts to crack down on critical media outlets from Russia to China to Venezuela and beyond?
No, I'm not remotely concerned about that.
Do you think the president should look to Europe, South Korea, Japan, and other more successful nations to learn about how to better contain this pandemic?
An awful lot to unpack there, Senator. First, I would tell you that some of the countries that you identified, you're looking at the data that they're putting out, it's worthless. So when you're comparing it to data from other countries, one ought not in a Senate hearing put that data forward as dispositive about the conditions on the ground in those countries. It's silly. They're not counting cases. So we need to make sure we have a shared factual database. Yeah, we should look everywhere to get best practices about how to respond to this. And I know that our doctors, Dr. Perks, who works for me, is now over at the White House working on us, they've done that. And we'll continue to do that to make sure we protect the American people in an appropriate way.
Senator Barrasso.
Could you talk about the administration's commitment to opposing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and applying sanctions against those companies aiding in the completion of this Russian trap?
You know, the irony is that this administration is accused by some of not being tough on Russia. I mean, President Trump personally took on this. He saw that this was a threat, this pipeline being a threat created enormous leverage for Russia, not only against Germany and broader Europe, but Ukraine as well. And so we set about, and with good support on Capitol Hill, we got legislation that was appropriate to now have delayed this project significantly. We need further tools. We're prepared to use those tools should you provide them to us. And we've also used our diplomatic capabilities to make clear to countries that we're going to do the other end too, right? We're going to make sure that American LNG can be sold into these countries. We want Europe to have a secure, stable, diverse set of energy opportunities, and our Department of Energy has worked alongside of us to do that. And our ENR department, Assistant Secretary Fannin, are working to make sure that Europe has real, secure, stable, safe energy sources that cannot be turned off in the event that Russia decides they want to do so. We think Nord Stream 2 is dangerous in that respect. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that that pipeline doesn't threaten Europe.
What do Russia and China want the Iran arms embargo? Why would they want it to expire? And is the Chinese Communist Party really willing to betray global security in order to be Iran's arms dealer?
Well, I hope not, but I expect so. We've been working to convince the Russians to permit this arms embargo to be extended. We're talking to the Chinese for months and months and months. We're working with our E3 counterparts as well. We will submit a UN Security Council resolution in the near future, where we will offer to extend this. This was one of the central failings of the JCPOA, was to have only a five-year ban on the Iranian capacity to both purchase weapon systems, build out air defense systems, the capacity to protect a nuclear program should they continue down that path, but also to sell weapons around the world and become, again, as they were before, one of the world's largest arms dealers. We're going to do everything we can. We believe we have the capacity to do this at the United Nations. We hope that the UN Security Council will conclude that extending this arms embargo is the right thing. In the event they don't, we're going to use every tool that we have at our fingertips to make sure that that arms embargo is not lifted on October 18th of this year. We think it decreases stability in the Middle East. We think that would threaten Israel, and we're confident reduces American security as well.
Could you discuss efforts by the administration you've taken to promote international religious freedoms?
So we have raised the priority of international religious freedom inside of the State Department. I think that's happened, I think, under President Trump and Vice President Pence. That's happened all across the administration. We use our diplomatic tools to encourage it. We build resilience. We work with religious communities in many countries to provide them security. The work that we're doing in northern Iraq today is a good example. But there's still lots of challenges. What's happening in Nigeria to Christians today, what's happening to Muslims in western China, your point about the threat to religious freedom and the exercise of conscience for people of all faiths is under attack in too many places. State Department has an important role to increase the capacity for people to exercise their rights of religious freedom. And we've held these two ministerials. We weren't able to do it this year because of the virus. but we brought people from all across the world. The world's largest human rights gatherings in all of history were held at the State Department twice around the central idea that people need to be able to exercise this important right to just have their own faith.
Can you talk about the recent confrontations by China and what that taught us about China's military ambitions as well as their capabilities? Because when we go to secure briefings, we ask lots about their capabilities, not just what they might do, but what they can do, not will they or won't they, but can they or can't they?
So I think these actions, and when you say recent, the last 24, 36 months, I think the actions are entirely consistent with what they have been signaling to the world for decades. You might even argue since 1989, but certainly since General Secretary Xi came to power. It's a desire to expand their power, their reach. They talk about this, right? They talk about bringing socialism with Chinese characteristics to the world, and whether it's you identified some, but a claim that they've now made for real estate in Bhutan, the incursion that took place in India. These are indicative of Chinese intentions, and they're testing, they're probing the world to see if we're going to stand up to their threats and their bullying. And I'm more confident than I was even a year ago that the world is prepared to do that. There's a lot more work to do, and we need to be serious about it.
Senator Murphy.
So just a simple question on behalf of my constituents and maybe my colleagues as well. Should we view Andrei Derkach as a credible source of information?
Look, I don't want to comment on any particular individual like Mr. Derkach. I will say this. We're taking seriously the threats that Russia will try to engage in disinformation campaigns, that there may be oligarchs that try and engage in this, there may be foreign actors, not just Russian. We were pretty successful at this in the 2018 election. I say we, not the State Department alone, but all the United States government. I'm confident we will be in this one as well.
Why wouldn't you be willing to opine on a specific individual if you had information to suggest that the source was not credible? It seems as if that is, in fact, a core function of the U.S. government, if it has information to that would suggest malign influence, to let Congress and the American people know.
Yeah. So when it's appropriate, I will. When there's still work ongoing and there's still unsettled intelligence around these things, I'm going to try to be just a little bit more careful, Senator.
As you step back and try to articulate this sort of broad strategy to counteract China's growing influence in the world, how does withdrawal from the WHO counteract the growing influence of China?
So it's a good question. These are close calls sometimes, right? We left the UN Human Rights Council. The same argument was made, better to fight from within than to try and reform from outside. I think there are reasonable arguments that can be made on either side. The decision that the president made, and I concur with this decision, we went through multiple rounds of reforms at the World Health Organization. Our team in Geneva fought for years, and previous administrations too. And each time we got reforms, there was no capacity to make that a science-based organization and not a political one. And there comes a point where you're spending $500 million of U.S. taxpayer money year on year that goes to benefit political actors inside the World Health Organization. And we ultimately made the conclusion that we were more likely to achieve the global health security issues that the United States cares about deeply if we did not participate any further in the World Health Organization. I am not at all convinced that it will be China that benefits from that. I'm convinced that the world will benefit. We saw it with PEPFAR. We've seen it with Gavi. We've seen it other places. When the United States leads, and we will absolutely lead, good things can happen in the international health realm.
Senator Portman, we worked with one of your Pearson fellows. You told me about the Pearson Fellowship, and I took advantage of it. The last year, Mark Weebles has been working with us. He's a consular affairs officer. Mm-hmm. He's done a terrific job. And we have put together some legislation that's very balanced, says, hey, we want research. We want the American Research Enterprise to benefit from international cooperation, but we don't want to have this U.S. taxpayer-funded research being stolen. So I thank you for that. I would just ask you, do you agree that these new visa authorities we have in that legislation are helpful to protect taxpayer-funded research and intellectual property from our adversaries, including China?
They definitely are, and we need an expanded tool set to make sure that we get this right. We're making progress. Our teams working alongside the FBI to identify these risks are working hard on this set of issues. I'll say this, too. We all need to be candid. When we go back to our home states and we talk to the universities in our states, the education industrial complex is alive and well. We need to be candid with them about what's taking place in some of these institutions of higher learning all across America and be thoughtful about how we respond to this this influence and theft operation that's being conducted.
How important is it to get Lieutenant General Dayton confirmed as the ambassador in Ukraine, number one? I think he's highly qualified. I'm really pleased with that nomination. And number two, do you agree with what we just did in the National Defense Authorization Bill, which was to have a record amount of lethal aid going to Ukraine? We've gone from roughly $50 million to $125 million in that legislation. Do you support that increased funding for lethal aid for Ukraine to be able to defend itself?
I do. The administration does support the increase in lethal aid. It's important to get the general out there, although I will say our charge on the ground there today is doing a very, very good work. But it's important to get a confirmed ambassador in that position. If I might just add this, too. We're still thinking it was a real loss when Ambassador Volker departed. The work that he was doing was important to the State Department's overall effort in the region, and we're hoping to get that position with just the right person filled as well, so that we have a full-on effort there to help the Ukrainian people maintain their democracy.
I think moving troops out of Germany is a good idea if they stay in Europe. And in particular, Poland has been asking for years now, you know, to allow U.S. troops to come to Poland. They've even offered us a base. I was there several years ago where they agreed to, pay for the base. And I don't know if that's still an offer. But the Baltics, Eastern Europe in particular, it seems to me that's the appropriate place to move those troops. And I agree that Germany is not the right place for the number of troops that we have. Rather, they should be closer to where the action is and, frankly, the countries that are at most risk right now. So I don't know if you have any comment on that, but I would hope that they would be able to stay in Europe.
Senator, I'll leave to the Department of Defense to talk about exact dispositions and numbers in particular countries. But with respect to Poland, we don't yet have our defense cooperation agreement quite done. And so the State Department's working diligently with our DOD colleagues to get that done so that in the event the Department of Defense makes that decision, the President concludes it's the right thing to do, we can put those forces in there in a way that protects them as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Kaine.
Can a President delay the November presidential election, Mr. Secretary?
Senator, I'm not going to enter a legal judgment on that on the fly this morning.
Mr. Secretary, you are an honors graduate of West Point. You are a graduate of the Harvard Law School. You were on the Harvard Law Review. I was at Harvard Law School, and I went to a lot of Red Sox games. I went on the Harvard Law Review.
You are very kind of you. You
are one of the most highly trained and accomplished lawyers who are part of this administration. Can a president delay a presidential election?
Senator, the Department of Justice, others will make that legal determination. We all should want, I know you do too, Senator Kaine, want to make sure we have an election that everyone is confident in. It's not only free,
are you indifferent to the date of the election?
It should happen lawfully.
Right.
Yeah.
Was Marie Yovanovitch a talented public servant?
Senator, I'm not going to comment on that personnel matter.
Was she a valuable part of the State Department family?
Senator, again, the President made the very clear decision that he preferred that she not be our ambassador. It's fully within his right.
Every one
of us that takes on these jobs knows that at any minute we could be gone.
I'm not asking that. This is not a question about the President's power.
Yes.
I'm asking about your opinion of her as a public servant.
Senator, I didn't interact with Ambassador Yovanovitch.
You did not?
No, not significantly.
So you do not really have you don't consider that you have
Senator, I'm not going to talk about this. There will be a place and a time for me to talk about this, and I'm looking forward to that. It is not the case that I talk about personnel matters.
You were very willing to tell us what you didn't like about the Inspector General.
That's in response to
Senator Menendez.
I was. Very different situation. A very, very different situation. There have been accusations about misconduct and malfeasance and assertions that I fired someone because they're investigating me, that it demands a response. There's going to be a public report
I want to make sure this is different.
And I've been steadfast in this. So you've asked me about other ambassadors before, too. I haven't talked about them who were great and doing wonderful things. I didn't say that either.
You've been steadfast. I'm trying to determine whether you've been steadfast or not, since I have so many State Department employees that live in the Commonwealth of Virginia
Yes.
who are very, very concerned about whether or not a Secretary of State might have the back of a career professional who is a valued person. You were on a phone call with President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine when the president said about Ambassador Yovanovitch, she's going to go through some things. You know what the president meant when he said that?
I don't.
But you were on that call. That's been reported.
Yes, I was.
When he said that about Marie Yovanovitch, did you ever follow up and ask the president what he meant?
Senator, I'm confident that every action we took with Ambassador Yovanovitch was completely appropriate.
That's not the question I asked.
But it's the truth.
Well, that may be the truth, but how about answering my question?
I'm not going to talk about internal discussions at the State Department. You wouldn't want me to. Neither would your constituents, Senator Kaine. They wouldn't want the Secretary of State to come up here and talk about internal conversation about personnel matters. You know that. That's not appropriate.
Well, can you just listen to my question?
Sure,
you were on the phone call.
Yeah.
You heard the president say that about Marie Yovanovitch. And my question to you is, did you ask what the president meant about that?
Senator Austin.
Yes or no?
The answer is I'm not going to talk about either. I guess that you're asking, did I ask the president?
Yeah.
What he meant. I don't talk about conversations.
You told me you don't know what he meant.
Yes.
But I just asked if you
yeah,
asked.
And I understand. I appreciate your question, and I hope you can appreciate why I don't talk about conversations with the president.
What was your response to Rudy Giuliani's effort to sack Ambassador Yovanovitch? Did you say, hey, it's not your job, this is my job?
President of the United States has the unconditional right to have the ambassadors
he wants. Stipulated for the record.
But
what was your interaction with Rudy Giuliani?
I appreciate this. Don't go into great magical effects with respect to how a package came. It's all silliness. You should know for the record that package was delivered to Capitol Hill by the former Inspector General, who ran frantically to Capitol Hill and made a big news.
My time is up. I'm just going to say, you might think this is silly.
Yeah.
You might think these questions are silly,
yeah.
But when somebody works for their entire career for the State Department and they are slandered with lies and sacked for no good reason, that sends a message that could not be clearer to other State Department officials. And it may be just a big joke. I mean, hey, look at you smiling and laughing and calling
it
silly. I don't think it's silly to Marie Yovanovitch or the people who work for you.
I don't think it's silly to the United States Department of State to understand that every ambassador, every political appointee knows that the President of the United States finds that they lack confidence in you, the President has the right to terminate them. It's that easy. It includes me.
Senator Paul.
That's straightforward. And you should note, I didn't slander anyone. I did. This was handled appropriately and properly, Senator.
You know, what is our current mission? Why are we in Afghanistan? Do we have a cogent military reason to be in Afghanistan right now?
So the President has given two missions. One is to reduce our force posture, both the risk to our young men and women who are fighting there. And the second is to ensure that there's not a terror attack that emanates from that space. We set about conducting a peace and reconciliation process. We've now reduced forces there by about half since their most recent peak. We're on our way to reduce even further. I'm hopeful that we will get the Afghans to begin their negotiation because President Trump has made very clear his expectation. We've entered into agreement that we'll go to zero. We'll get our forces out of there. I think it's May of next year. And we're looking to do that on terms that make sure we protect America from a
Would you agree that Afghanistan is just one of probably hundreds of places that we potentially have terror threats or radical Islamic threats and may not even be no longer the primary place?
If you'll give me dozens and dozens, yes, sir, absolutely.
Yeah. Is our goal in these locations around the world our national security, or is our goal sometimes muddied by the idea that basically – you know, we're in Afghanistan for the Equal Rights Amendment or for women's rights, or we're there for, you know, democracy or making a country out of Afghanistan.
I think President Trump's made it unambiguous. Our mission set there is American national security, plain and simple. I'd add only this. There are times in the world where we are better off if there are democratic nations. The State Department is designed, right, to build resilience to do this kind of thing, but I do think our foreign policy sometimes has been overly ambitious about what it is we can accomplish through the use of military force with respect to getting other nations to.
Well, I think look encouraging more like democracy America. And being part of supportive of democracy doesn't mean we have to pay for trying to institute our image in some other country, because it just doesn't, frankly, work. So I hope the people who are remaining will try to fulfill the president's policy and get us out of the war in Afghanistan. Thank you.
If I may just take 1 second, Senator Risch, with your permission, your point, Senator Paul, about the. About the global spectrum of terrorism and the fact that there are dozens of al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. I think that's a central thing that the American people need to understand. Wherever we were 15 or 20 years ago is not where we are today. And our resources, whether it's our decision in Germany or decision about force posture in Asia or Africa or in Afghanistan or Syria or any place else, we need to make sure that it's updated for the actual threats presented to the United States of America. And that's what President Trump is driving us to do.
Senator Merkley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Secretary. I want to start with the events that have occurred in Hong Kong and what I really see as a violation of the agreement made with Britain, between China and Britain. And now that these events, this new Chinese law that really exerts enormous violations of civil rights in Hong Kong has occurred, should we extend asylum and visa opportunities to those who are being persecuted by the Chinese in Hong Kong?
We're reviewing that. We're considering it. The British have made a good decision. The Australians have made a decision. They're going to accept up to hundreds of thousands of people. We're looking at how best we might accomplish this, and consistent with making sure that we always want to encourage people to try to work from within to the extent they can as well. And so it's important that we get this right. And the president is actively considering how we ought to treat those who seek asylum coming to us from Hong Kong, or to grant a visa program that surrounds that.
Well, it sounds like you're open to the opportunity and are reviewing it. And I do feel like there are folks who will be highly targeted. And they are concerned about being locked up for the rest of their lives, young folks, 18, 20 years old, in China, Chinese prisons. Do the events in Hong Kong change our perspectives on Taiwan, or make us think about ways to be more supportive of Taiwan? We obviously do a lot of arms sales and so forth, but should we be more active in supporting Taiwanese participation in international institutions?
Senator, they are different situations. There was an agreement with Hong Kong. Taiwan is all. They are different, but I think it's fair to say that the Chinese Communist Party views them as the same, right? If you ask the Chinese Communist Party, they would both view them as part of their territory, and so that requires diligence. And your question about international organizations, not only the team that I have assigned to that, but the regional bureaus as well, are working on multiple fronts. We took a run at this in the World Health Assembly now a couple months back, and we've taken this on at the United Nations to make sure that Taiwan is represented in every place that it's appropriate that they be represented as part of formal and informal international gatherings.
There's a longstanding convention that the President of the United States should not meet with the President of Taiwan because it would offend China. Do you agree with that longstanding convention?
Senator, if I may defer that, I'm happy to have a conversation with you about it. Here's what I'll say with respect to Taiwan. There are a series of understandings that have been long held, multiple administrations, multiple parties. We intend to continue to honor that. We understand the Taiwan Relations Act and the obligations that the United States government has with respect to that. We're working to recognize the changes that General Secretary Xi has made with respect to this, and we want to make sure we get this right.
Saudi Arabia has been abetting the flight of Saudi nationals who have done horrific crimes in America. And so really two questions. Do you agree that this effort to sweep people out of our country who have done or are charged with doing horrific things before they can be tried is unacceptable? And do you agree, if it continues to occur, the U.S. should use significant diplomatic consequences for Saudi Arabia?
Yes to both questions, Senator.
Thank you. So there is the report that Well, we've done several things in regard to the situation in Xinjiang and the Chinese incarceration, basically slave camps of a million Uyghurs. And we've done some recent things, and I applaud those recent steps to impose sanctions to block exports that were done with forced labor in China. But I also feel like there's another narrative that has undermined kind of the effectiveness of this. And as we've heard about the president's comments in November 2017 trip to China, where he indicated that President Xi should go ahead with building concentration camps. And then again in June 2019, a year and a half later, President Trump's conversation with President Xi, saying again, basically, it should go ahead building the camps and it's the right thing to do. I think it's absolutely the wrong thing to do. And we have done some, as I noted, some steps that suggest that's, but should we be more robust at every level in condemning the Chinese enslavement of the Uyghurs?
Senator, I think the answer is yes. I'm proud of what we've done, the way that the United States has responded, not only the responses we've taken directly, but the work we've done around the world to convince the whole world of what's taking place there. I've been disappointed to see Muslim countries not respond when they're often significant Muslim populations being impacted there in Western China. We're urging them to take this on in a serious way. And then I guess the last thing I'd say is, I think with the objective of changing the behaviors that are taking place there, this is an important economic region. And so the things that we're endeavoring to do, it's important we get the human rights piece of this right. It's important that we get the individual sanctions piece of this right, but it is very important, and I'm really happy with the work we're making to convince businesses, not just American businesses, because it's an international place of business, that they should really look hard at their supply chains, not just their direct employees, but their supply chains and what's taking place there. I think if we get that right, we have the opportunity to change what's taking place there.
Is it time to reevaluate our relationship, which has been quite cozy, with the president of Honduras?
Senator, we're constantly demanding that the leadership in Honduras take these set of facts on board. We're well aware of what's taking place, and like in too many countries around the world, we've not had the effect that we desire. We're working on it.
Senator Young.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, you may recall meeting with the Kasich family last year, but as brief refresher, in October 2013, Indiana native and former Army Ranger Peter Kasich was on a mission of mercy. He was delivering humanitarian aid to suffering people in Syria. He was taken hostage by ISIS, and sadly, after months of torture and incredible hardship at the hands of these ISIS terrorists, and in spite of his embrace of Islam, he was brutally beheaded. I believe that the United States government should work tirelessly, independently, and with the cooperation of allies to hunt down the killers of these Americans and bring them to justice here in the United States of America. Mr. Secretary, do you agree with me?
I do, and you should know that the President of the United States agrees as well.
What efforts can the State Department and our missions overseas take to bring this about?
So it's a broad effort. I think we're making progress. It's Department of Defense, their intelligence assets, the broader set of U.S. intelligence assets, all aimed at making sure we understand, and then working with important partners, too, who want justice but have a different set of rules about how to think about that. So working to convince them that proceeding to bring them to justice is the right approach. I'm very hopeful that we will, in the coming weeks, have a good outcome here.
You alluded to different perspectives that exist out there. What precise obstacles stand in the way, and what can you do to overcome them?
So an example, and I'll stay away from this particular instance, but an example is when we make a decision from time to time to bring someone back from someplace else, either through extradition or through through another legal process, the country will say because we have the death penalty or because of a certain set of rules we have here, they won't either permit that to happen or share the information that we might need to complete a successful prosecution. And one of our roles is to make sure that those countries will permit us to do that.
Will you commit to working with me in this committee to ensure that we pursue this matter accordingly?
Of course, yes, sir.
All right, thank you. So building on Senator Murphy's earlier line of questioning, why don't we look beyond the World Health Organization? And I ask you, Mr. Secretary, what implications does this losing of ground within UN bodies and agencies have on advancing U.S. national security interests and other foreign policy priorities that we might have in the UN system?
Yeah, it's very significant, and it is a at least 15-year-long slide that has taken place and growth of the Chinese Communist Party's influence in these institutions and organizations. We've done a couple things to turn this around. We had real success at the World International Property Organization, right? The Chinese thought they had the fast track to that. We put up a good candidate. It wasn't an American candidate, but it was a candidate that we believe has an understanding of intellectual property in the same way that freedom-loving democracies do, and we crushed them. And it was an amazing diplomatic effort. We built coalitions with the Indians, the Brits, the Australians, and then built it out all across the world. We're asking for about $20 million in this budget to take the team that we built there and make it a permanent team that is focused on these major elections for these 15 institutions. And then there's another set that are slightly different but still very important. And then we have a second set of operations, which is it's not just the leaders that matter at these UN organizations. They have big bureaucracies underneath them. And we are, sadly, inadequately represented at every level inside of these international bodies, and it matters. It matters that there's someone there. It matters that they're American, but it matters that they, if they're not American, that they come from the nations that understand the rule of law and how the world ought to be conducted in a way that we do. And so I've actually worked closely with about seven other countries to build out an effort that is very focused on exactly this. Sometimes, frankly, we've had opportunities. We just didn't we were offered a place and didn't put anybody forward. That's not the right way to go. We need to make sure we get it right. I'm confident that in a year and 2 years, we'll be in a better place than we are today, and I hope we'll have the resources to do that. It's a little bit of a resource issue, but it's a lot of a focus issue, and I think I've cleaned that up materially.
Senator Perdue.
Can you articulate what the threats the Chinese Communist Party threatens or makes or represents to our democracy and our freedoms here? And what are we doing as a Chinese strategy as we try to manage during your administration here, as we try to manage this turn in our relationship with China to confront them, to stand up to them, but also to protect our freedoms here at home?
So, Senator, there are multiple fronts to this. And these aren't created by the Department of State. They're created by what the Chinese Communist Party says, to your point. And President Trump recognized that. He talked about it in his campaign back as far as 2015. We've got to get this imbalance corrected. And when we do, there'll be costs associated with that. We've got the largest increase in our military buildup that President Trump has led. We're very focused on an arms control strategic dialogue that we're having today. It was in Vienna on the 27th and 28th of this month, a few days back. We know we need China to be part of that, too. They're now a significant nuclear power. We've seen what's happened on the economic front. We see their Belt and Road Initiative. So they're competing. Senator Rubio talked about their efforts in four or five technology spheres. This is a multi-front campaign. It will take not only the United States government, but the United States citizens to understand this challenge. And then we've got to build out the global alliance. And last thing I'll say here is I've seen it said that the United States is asking nations to pick sides between China and the United States. It's fundamentally false. We're asking every sovereign country to pick between freedom and tyranny. And that's the choice every leader's got to make. And that's when I go around the world, that's what I talk to them about. And they all know. They all know that the United States is the country that they want to be alongside. They all know that freedom and our value system and the rule of law and property rights and the protection of these unalienable rights is central to their country. And it's why I think the tide is turning around the world and that people are seeing the Chinese Communist Party for what it is, the threat to the security of their people.
Thank you, Senator Perdue. Senator Graham.
When it comes to a UN envoy for Libya, do you support that we need a new one?
Yes.
Good. And I'm going to try to get a letter from everybody in the committee to the UN Secretary General saying, please appoint a special envoy. And, Ms. Secretary, anything we can do to up our game would be great. I know you work with the Berlin folks, and
yes,
we'll see if we can
and we need
bring
the right
more stability.
Too, Senator. I know you agree with that, not just a new one, but the right person as well.
Okay, thank you very much. The CSERS Act, thank you for using it quickly and in a holding Assad's son accountable is a great first step in what I think will be a long journey to punish this regime. Is more coming?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Great job. I talked to General Muslun yesterday with the SDF. Apparently, they've signed a deal with an American oil company to modernize the oil fields in northeastern Syria. Are you supportive of that?
We are.
That would be a great way to help everybody in northeastern Syria.
The deal took a little longer, Senator, than we had hoped, and we now are in implementation. It could be very powerful.
You've been terrific in that regard. When it comes to Afghanistan, is it my understanding correct that any withdrawal from Afghanistan will be conditions-based?
That's correct.
And the inter-Afghan dialogue hopefully will start here fairly soon?
Yes.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yes.
So I applaud you.
I don't mean to make light of that. We're very hopeful that in the next week, I fear that I may have said that once before.
Right. Is it fair to say that in 2020, Chinese Communist Party is running concentration camps to that house religious minorities?
I'll be careful about the language. I've described it this way, Senator. It is
something like a concentration.
It is the worst human rights violation that we have seen this century.
We just passed in the Judiciary Committee legislation modeled on JASTA, allowing Americans who have been victims of the coronavirus to sue the Chinese Communist Party. Do you support that?
I haven't had a chance to take a look at
it. We'll get it to you. Where do you see the Iranian regime in terms of their potency? Are the sanctions working? And what would you advise this committee to do going forward with Iran?
So, Senator, the sanctions have clearly had an impact. It has diminished their capacity to underwrite Hezbollah, the Shia militias in Iraq, but clearly hasn't achieved the ultimate objective, which is to change the behavior of the Iranian regime. And so our view is this. We're happy to see them change, but until such time as they do, we see the best tools to starve the regime of the capacity to inflict terror around the world. So your support in doing that is very important. And I talked a little bit earlier, I think you hadn't arrived just yet, about the UN arms embargo that we're working so diligently to make sure it doesn't expire in a couple months.
I would urge you to work with us to try to find a way, if we can get a vaccine developed, to get it to the developing world, sort of like what we did with the PEPFAR, because it will do no good to eradicate it here if we don't eradicate it everywhere. Would you work with us in that regard?
Yes, we've presented something that we've given the name Piper Pro, something that's modeled on PEPFAR that ultimately we think could be very successful if we can get a vaccine. We're happy to work with you all on it.
Senator Cruz.
The administration has the authority, I believe, to sanction companies working to build this pipeline. Your predecessor, Secretary Tillerson, had issued, as I understand it, a guidance that was widely interpreted as essentially exempting Nord Stream 2. And you made the right decision to rescind that guidance. Can you explain to the committee the importance of that guidance and what authority the administration has right now today, with no additional legislation, to sanction any company, any German company, any other company that participates in any way with completing this pipeline?
Yep. So thanks, Senator Cruz. The president made that decision to change that language. It was my recommendation, so I'm not walking away from it. But I want to make sure everybody knew the president was fully on board with that. That change. That language was important because, to your point, and this is a little bit too simple, but it was essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card for those conducting activities surrounding Nord Stream 2. That's no longer true, and both the State Department and the Department of Treasury have made very clear in our conversations with those who have equipment there, and we can see that they're responding, as are their insurers, their board of directors, their lawyers, all understand the express threat that is posed to them for continuing to complete work on completion of the pipeline. And we remain hopeful that those who have the capacity to finish this pipeline quickly won't be able to do so. They'll choose not to because of these sanctions. And then we have the task of those that are harder to reach by sanctions, making sure that we do everything we can to stop them. The president's been so clear about the security threat that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline poses to Europe. We've not been able to convince the Germans of that. So we're taking action ourselves to try and accomplish that, to preserve security for the European people.
So I urge you to speak with absolute clarity, because it is only that clarity, I think, that has any prayer of actually stopping the completion of this pipeline. And if the pipeline is completed, it will do serious damages to the economic interest and the national security interest of Europe. It will do serious damage to the economic and national security interest of the United States, and it will benefit Putin and put billions of dollars in his pocket.
There's no need for ambiguity. The president hasn't been ambiguous about this at all. There was a reason that we made the change in that language, what essentially the waiver language, if you will. We're fully intent of sanctioning those that violate the provisions that are contained there, both in CATS and otherwise.
Under the terms of the Obama-Iran nuclear deal and the UN Security Council resolution implementing it, the United States has the authority to invoke snapback sanctions if and when Iran is in violation of the deal. We have that authority even though we have withdrawn from that deal. Iran is now nakedly, openly, flagrantly flouting the deal. They're not pretending to comply with it. It is obvious they are defying it, and they're telling us they're defying it. Will the United States invoke the snapback sanctions, which would result in reimposing not just American sanctions, but far broader sanctions on Iran for their violations of the deal?
I think the president's been very clear. We believe we have this authority. I've spoken to this a couple of times. We believe that under a UN Security Council Resolution 2231, we clearly have the authority to do this, and that we are not going to permit this arms embargo to expire on October 18th. We're going to introduce a UN Security Council resolution. We hope will be met with approval from the other members of the P5. In the event that it's not, we're going to take the action necessary to ensure that this arms embargo doesn't expire. We have the capacity to execute snapback, and we're going to use it in a way that protects and defends America.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please get on Facebook and Twitter and tell your friends and followers about the Lawfare podcast, and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. You can purchase Lawfare swag at www.thelawfarestore.com. This episode was edited by me, Elena Kagan. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.